Good evening, one and all. Yes, I know it's a Tuesday and it's another Book and a Chat with me, Barry Eva, your host. I've been going on for 10 years now saying that sort of stuff. Anyway, it's me back again. Here we are, just a few days before Christmas. And this last weekend, we actually had a foot of snow here in Connecticut where I am. It's still around on the gardens. The roads and paths are all clear, but we're still around. And now I just got a warning about 5 minutes before the show started from the electricity board to expect Thursday going into Friday storms with winds of 70 miles an hour. So we're having our normal weather for actually it's December. It normally happens in like February here lately, it seems to be, but it is what it is. And you know, at least it's not as bad as being in England where you can't even travel and meet your family this year. But if that's the way it goes. But I am here, and so is my guest. Now, my guest, he's done some articles and publishing like that, but he was also a decorated combat infantry officer in Vietnam, part of the 1st Air Cavalry. And he's done sort of quite a lot of president sales and stuff like that. But now he's sharing with us a book, and it's a fascinating book because the book is called 39 Tiny Mistakes That Changed the World Forever. You know, things that, well, did they get on the plane? Shouldn't they got on the plane? Think of the Titanic. You know, what about if they slowed down and didn't go carry on going on? Think little things right. Like that. Anyway, let's get him on the show and find out more about it, because on the show today I have the one and only Jared Knott. Hi, Jared. How are you doing?
Doing fine. It's an honor to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. As I said, you look back throughout history and there are little mistakes, little sort of tiny things that matter. You know, at the time you thought, well, what did it matter? I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day, for instance, being in England, about the Battle of Hastings, and the English Harold was winning that, the long-handled axes, you know, kept the Normans at bay. But then when the Normans turned round to either a mock retreat or, you know, made it look like one sort of thing, an actual retreat. And of course, the English
disobeyed orders
and charged down after them. Yeah, little
right.
things like that.
They had no armor. Now they're out in the field exposed.
Yeah.
With long axes, that sort of thing. Behind the barricades, they're doing just fine. They got out there in the open. William the Conqueror thought there was a rumor that he had died, but then they heard his very loud voice to counterattack, and they caught the Britons out there in the open field with no armor, and they slaughtered them, and that was it. Right there.
Well, yeah.
If I followed orders and stayed behind the barricades, they might
exactly.
Have
and this is what we hear, you know, time and again. I remember English Civil War. Rupert led the cavalry because he thought they were winning, chased after people, and they lost the battle, which lost the, you know, the War of Independence in England and stuff like that. Where did you get the idea from to sort of do a book on this, Jared?
Yes, well, there's this old adage that was made famous in part by Benjamin Franklin, that for want of the nail, the shoe was lost. For want of the shoe, the rider was lost. For want of the rider, the battle was lost. For want of the battle, the empire was lost. The empire was lost, all for the want of a nail.
Yeah.
I was wondering, you know, how often does it really happen? Is that just kind of a little cute saying, or does it really happen? And I began to think, well, here's this one example. Here's another example. After a while, I had like 10 or 12. Well, that's enough for a magazine article. And I kept accumulating more and more and more. Actually, I say 39. There's really about 45 or 50 stories in the book of a teeny example of a mistake that multiplied and dominoed and ended up causing an entire empire to collapse or a nation to collapse.
Exactly.
And two things happen. Would you like an example?
Yes, please. Let's go through a few examples.
Yes, sir. A single piece, each one kind of has a little teaser. A single piece of tape rotated several inches the wrong direction changed the outcome of the Vietnam War. The United States might very well have won, except for this single tiny mistake, okay, which doesn't make any sense, really, does it? I mean, piece of tape, what am I talking about? Well, it has to do with the Watergate break-in. The burglars jimmied the lock from the parking garage into the main office building. They were told to hold the striker of the door down with a single piece of tape in the vertical position so it could not be seen from the outside. They made a mistake and they put it in the horizontal position across the door face. So when the night watchman came walking by, he sees the tape on the door. Tape on the door, what's going on? Oh, the door has been jimmied. Oh, he calls the police, and the police come out. the whole Watergate thing begins, which causes the Nixon administration to collapse. And Henry Kissinger was saying that they knew that the North Vietnamese were going to be testing the treaty, and the plan was to go back there and bomb the living daylights out of them again to get them back in compliance. They were so weak politically they couldn't. South Vietnam collapses, Nixon administration collapses, the whole thing falls apart because of a single piece of tape.
Yeah. Go ahead.
There's also a subset to that story. When the call first came in for the police to come out, they called for the uniform officer on the scene to go by and investigate. But the strong rumor indicates that the uniform officer was drunk at a bar and could not respond. So they sent the bum patrol instead. That was like three officers dressed as hobos in a jalopy car. So when they pulled up to the Watergate complex, the lookout did not recognize them as police, so it was long since too late. But if the officer had been on duty with his uniform, they'd have called in and warned them, the people, the burglars, to escape right away. The whole thing might have been avoided. So the whole thing was a single piece of tape rotated several inches in the wrong direction, plus a drunk cop.
Yeah. I mean, I'd heard about the cop. I must admit before, something about the tape, I didn't know exactly what, but it is these little things, and at the time you think, well, that's nothing, isn't it?
Right.
Like you said, throughout its history, whether it's circumstances or whether it's like, I don't know, you just think of, the Buddy Holly flight or whatever, you know, a couple of people didn't get on the plane for whatever reason, you know, and that didn't die. And,
right.
And Glenn Miller, you know, did he have to take off, you know, in the fog? They said, oh, no, you don't want to take off in the fog. And he did. Well, and, another one there.
The Glenn Miller story, which is not in my book, but apparently what happened, this story comes out years later because it's embarrassing to certain people, but apparently when the bombers would fly over to Germany and drop their bombs, sometimes they were not able to drop all their bombs.
Mm.
And so as they came back over, they would drop the bombs over the English Channel because they don't want to land with the bombs.
Yeah.
It's dangerous landing with several explosives on board. Well, anyway, they were coming back, dropping their bombs down to the English Channel, and flying below them was apparently Glenn Miller's plane, and the bombs hit the plane and caused it to crash.
Okay, that's what I've heard, Yeah. I know they were looking... Oh, like in the last 5 years, wasn't it? There was a big thing looking for his plane. They worked out where the bombers might have been and everything like that. So, yeah, but again, little circumstances like that you wouldn't think of anything, and it just adds up, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And, let me give you another one, if I may.
Yes, yeah, please do. Let's go through them. Yeah.
Yeah. One single document, poorly designed by one single clerk, and one single county changed the outcome of a presidential election and led directly to a major war. The war would not have taken place except for this single tiny mistake, okay? And that had to do with the 2000 election done in Florida. It's not the hanging chads.
Right.
It's something called a butterfly ballot. It's done in Palm Beach County. The lady's name was Teresa Lepore, and she was the clerk of elections. And she wanted to make the printing on the ballots big so the old people down there could read the ballot easily. So she came up with this ballot that was a two-page ballot. It was a left page and a right page with a single row of punch holes down the center. Well, the way it was designed, Al Gore was the second name on the page to the left, but he was the number three punch hole. The number two name on the right side of the page was Pat Buchanan. Well, okay, so Pat Buchanan and surrounding counties got 100, 200, maybe 300 votes. And this one particular county gets like 5,000 votes, okay? Because people were acting like punching his hole instead of Al Gore's hole, okay? And sometimes they would punch both holes, which disqualified the ballot.
Right.
But anyway, it was very clear there was a huge amount of confusion. Well, Al Gore ends up losing the state by 456 votes. He would have easily gotten 2,000 or 3,000, if not 5,000 more with a correct ballot. He would have won Florida. He would have won the presidency. He was adamantly opposed to the war in Iraq. The entire war would not have taken place, cost 50,000 some odd lives, $3 trillion, the whole thing, because of a poorly designed ballot. Okay.
Wow.
They had Teresa Lepore in one of the morning talk shows. They were saying to her, people are saying that you're the one responsible for this war. And she was in tears. She was, okay, we appreciate the fact that you're crying, lady. We got 50,000 dead people and $3 trillion down the dumper because of your tiny mistake.
Yeah. But it is, as you say, sort of thing. What's the sort of oldest one you go back to?
Well, we have some in the ancient world. there's one that a soldier accidentally kicks a helmet off the top of a wall, and causes an entire empire to collapse. Okay, and that's kind of an interesting story. It has to do with Cyrus the Great. Okay, and he's facing. He was also facing Croesus, and there was a big battle there. And they originally fought the battle, and they fought to a standstill. And so then Cyrus the Great sails away, or pretends to sail away. Then the Spartans that were helping Croesus, they leave, and they didn't call him Cyrus the Great for nothing. So he sails right back again now that he has a depleted force, and once again lays siege to the city. Well, but he, of course, he sent word for the Spartans to come, plus they're going into winter, so it's kind of a questionable thing of whether they're going to be able to be successful or not. But here's the little quirk of fate. A soldier accidentally kicks a helmet off the top of the wall, okay, goes tumbling down the side of the wall. Well, he comes down and he walks down a pathway down the side of the wall, gets his helmet, walks all the way back up. Well, the soldiers there for Cyrus, they say, whoa, look, there's a pathway down the side of the wall.
Right.
Wow, wow. And so that same night or the next night, they organize a raiding party that goes up the pathway up the side of the wall, gets inside the city, comes over, opens up the gates, the army comes in, they conquer the entire city, and Croesus was either treated very warmly by Cyrus the Great, or was burned to death at a great big funeral pyre. Take your pick. We've got both stories. Probably burned to death.
Right.
And, but that was a little tiny mistake. The soldier had been more careful with his feet. Okay, the entire empire would have remained standing.
Yeah.
Without stopping.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's like what's the other Greek? The 300 Spartans. I mean, they were holding their own out until some shepherd led the Persians around the back path, which they didn't know about.
The traitor told them about a back way back around them, and so they got attacked from both sides. That's right. There was and then there's another little small one from one of your people over there. Was a bad King John.
Yes.
Okay, and he had he was traveling in his big caravan with his army, and he had the British. The British treasury with it.
Okay? Yep.
And it's something called the Walsh or the Wash.
The Wash, yeah.
Big, yeah, it's right. So he should have gone around the Wash, but he decided to go straight through.
Went straight,
with
yeah. He was in a rush, so he went straight across the Wash, yeah.
Yeah, so here comes the tide, and it takes the entire caravan of the treasury and tips it over down into the mud, okay? It's worth about $72 million today. They say it's down there somewhere in the 20, 30, 40 feet of mud.
Yeah.
No one knows where. Jewels, rubies, gold, silver coins.
The crown, the original crowns there. And yeah, I mean, I know that one well, King John's treasure there in the Wash. And, you know, it's one of these things you sort of say, it's there, but where?
Yeah. Where is it? You could walk one side or the other, and you probably come within 15 or 20 feet of it.
Yeah.
Which 15 or 20 feet is it? There it is right there, $72 million right underneath your
feet.
But,
too bad
there's no kind of a radar or any kind of a Geiger counter or something like that, and they could find it.
I think a couple of years ago, I was watching a program, and you know, there's two or three people that I reckon they're narrowing in on it, but it's like everything. It's like, you know, the lost mines and all this sort of stuff. You know, you get these people, they're narrowing in on it. And in fact, wasn't it? It's only recently that somebody's found one of the treasures. I've forgotten who I think it was a couple of weeks ago. He actually to own up who it was, the one that found one of these treasures. But it we know this stuff's there, but it's where.
Yeah, like ships that have sunk, I guess.
They'll
find them down there, and there's sometimes they're filled with, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars worth of gold from the old Spanish ships.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a huge bonanza there.
Yes, yeah, indeed. Along the way, I mean, and I know we were talking before the show, I mean, of all places, your book's really popular in Poland.
That's right.
I guess they like that sort of historical what ifs.
Yeah, it's funny. I look across the globe, and what the sales are highest. That's highest in the United States, and kind of highest in Canada. But then the usual spike there in Poland. It's 7 or 8 times what you expect it to be based on the size of the population. And so that's a nation that's been star-crossed with all kinds of unusual things being hit from the east and hit from the west. And
yeah.
So I guess they're very interested in history there, especially quirks and mistakes in history. But you know, it had an unusual reception in Poland, which I'm glad to say. Now, maybe someday I'll go over there to Krakow or to Warsaw and make a presentation to the historical club or the history museum or something like that over there. And I don't speak Polish, but hopefully they speak English. You know.
Right. No, it's interesting because, I mean, Poland's one of these countries. I mean, I know, well, this is going back 20 years. They were saying that there's over 5 million Poles in England, for instance, because a lot of them stayed there after the war, you know, just stayed on in there. And there's obviously a lot of Poles in America and stuff like that. And they're a bit of a nomadic tribe because Poland was always being invaded, you know, but by one country or another. It was part of this, it was part of that. And I think because of that, they're most likely interested in any sort of bits of history because their own history covers, you know, a large part of the world.
Yeah, they're caught in the crosswinds of a lot of wars. Again, the Russians coming from the east, the British and the Germans coming from the west, and there's always these things happening. They were, of course, the part of the Polish quarter being one of the motivations for World War II and so on and so forth.
Yep.
So they have just a natural interest in history there. And so I'd like to travel to Poland someday and meet with them. It might be a lot of fun.
I can agree with you, Poland. I also want to go to Hungary, which is a similar country that's been sort of, you know, kicked around by other countries of the world, in the world, sort of thing. I mean, both those places are sort of, they've got their own unique environment because of how they've been, the melting pot that sort of lived there, basically.
Well, they kind of got in a crush between East and West. Because the Russians on one side, Germans on the other side, and so on like that. So they've been going back and forth. I was just reading that their democracy is sort of getting in tatters, the strong man's starts taking over, starts putting his own people in positions of power, and the democratic institutions start getting compromised. So anyway, they're still going through a lot of turmoil. They were kind of like during the Cold War, they had kind of like a, what they call it, a goulash communism. It was communism that had a lot of free enterprise mixed in with it, and they did a little bit better than some of the other countries nearby that were communist. But they're doing fairly well, but they apparently being taken over. The strongman is kind of taking them over, which is what happened with Russia for a while there.
Yep.
Russia had some democracy, and then, of course, Putin's taken over, and the same thing sort of happening there in Hungary now.
Yeah,
so that's what happens. That's what happens. Democracy is a fragile thing, and it can be pushed aside with these powerful forces, unfortunately.
Very easily, indeed. The most stupid, shall I say, or the silliest thing that's like kicking the helmet off the wall sort of thing, but is there anything that's really quite shocking that how bad a mistake was that led to one of these changes?
When you ask that question, one example that comes to mind is the Titanic.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's actually, this oftentimes happens, there were several interlocking mistakes that caused the Titanic to sink. There was a fire on board, and also the steel was not particularly well made, the rivets were not particularly well made, and so on like that. But the smallest, dumbest mistake was the men up there in the tower, in the crow's nest, they were supposed to have binoculars, okay? And somebody accidentally, not sure exactly what happened, but the binoculars apparently were locked in a locker downstairs, and it didn't pass when they had a change of command there. It did not pass the key of the locker onto the next people. There they are up in the crow's nest, looking out over the dark ocean, looking for icebergs, and their binoculars are down in a locker someplace. They have no way of getting it open.
Crazy.
And after the sinking, there was a big investigation in New York, and they were talking to one of the gentlemen on there, and he said, what if you had the binoculars, would that have made a difference? Oh, yes, we'd have seen the iceberg well in advance. How soon in advance? Well, but plenty of time to be able to get out of the way. So just having the pair of binoculars there to be able to see the icebergs on the ocean would have saved the Titanic completely. So that's kind of small and a little bit dumb. Here's another one that's kind of infuriating. Now, of course, we have huge problems with China, and China was almost a democracy. Okay, it goes back to the 1919 Versailles Treaty. Okay,
yes,
and had a gentleman down there in Australia, who was the prime minister of Australia, who was Tony Blair. No, that's not right. No, Tony Hughes. Tony Hughes. Tony Hughes. Okay.
Yeah, Tony Blair's English. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Tony Hughes. Anyway, and he uh, he and Woodrow Wilson did not get along at all. They butted heads from the very beginning. Woodrow Wilson called him a pestilence environment, okay? A pestilence
right.
environment, okay? But anyway, but here's the story, is that Australia has thought of itself for many years as a white island floating in an Asian sea.
Uh-huh.
They did not want Asian immigrants coming into the country, lowering the wages and lowering the cost of the standard of living for the Australian workers. Okay, and also in western coast in California, the United States senators over there had the same motivation. They did not want a lot of Asians coming in, taking jobs from their voters. So both of those parties did not want there to be open immigration with Japan or the other Asian nations. Okay, but now at the end of World War II, Japan had helped the Allies quite a bit. They had defeated the Germans on the Pacific. They had taken control of the German concessions in China, because the foreign powers were coming to just take over parts of China, which is kind of weak at that point. And so at the end of the war, Japan wanted its share of the spoils. They wanted two things. They wanted the German concessions that they had conquered there at the end of the war. They also wanted, this is very important, a statement human rights, that all human beings of all ethnic groups should be treated equally and have equal rights. Okay, well, you can quote from the Declaration of Independence. That's pretty simple, pretty obvious. However, the Prime Minister down in Australia and also the senators in Western California were adamantly opposed. Wilson needed the votes of the senators to be able to get his League of Nations passed, which ended up not passing anyway. But so there was this big conflict. And the Japanese were insistent on this statement of democracy, okay, and their concessions. Well, in one of Wilson's 19 points, the most important of the 19 points was that there would be local determination of governments. You would not have a foreign power coming in and taking over and dictating to other people, okay? Well, the Chinese were expecting to have local self-determination. But on May 3rd, very important date, May 3rd, it was announced by Woodrow Wilson and the Versailles Treaty that they were not going to have that statement about equal rights and part of the Versailles Treaty. And they were going to give the Japanese the German concessions in China. That was announced on May 3rd. On the now infamous May 4th, the May 4th movement began,
mm-hmm.
okay, which grew and grew and grew and later became the communist movement. Mao Zedong became part of it. And here was the key thing. There was a statement made by Chinese nationalists. We had believed in Woodrow Wilson and the Western democracies, and then we decided that they were all great liars. Okay, so they rejected Western democracy. They turned to the philosophy coming out of Russia at the time, which was communism. May 4th movement became the communist movement. They embraced communism, and they went a completely different direction. If they just had a paragraph, all human beings should be treated equally and have equal rights, you know, with the laws of all nations, something like that. Just two sentences. That would satisfy the Japanese. They would not have to give them the concessions there in China. They would continue to embrace Woodrow Wilson and the Western democracies. And just like India and Japan and South Korea are democracies, mm-hmm. China would have been a democracy. And all these problems we had ever since then would have been avoided altogether.
So, right. Yeah, one sort of thing like that. And this is, you know, so it goes on, you know, through your book, Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters, 39 Tiny Mistakes That Changed the World Forever. As you said, mm-hmm. you know, you've got 39, but there's most likely a lot more. There's more in the book, but you most likely could have come across as like a second series almost.
Yes, actually, I like three chapters that the book's already a good-sized book. It's 430 pages, but three chapters I could have put in that I didn't, since the book's getting big enough. We have lots of fascinating subjects there. One of them is how the South came within a whisker of winning the war. Most people do not realize how close the South came to winning the war. And there's also the chain of events with the Kennedy family that determined who was going to be president of the United States in 1960. It might have been, except for a few little quirks, it might have been John Kennedy's older brother, Joe, as mm-hmm. opposed to John Kennedy himself. And then there's some, and there's one of my favorites. I'm from Texas. One of my favorites is what I call, it's called Victory Disease on the Texas Frontier. And it's about the Battle of San Jacinto. But there's lots of fascinating stories, major personalities, tiny mistakes, big disasters, and funny quirks that turn history on its head.
Indeed. And that's the way things are. I mean, it's, nobody's perfect. No, nobody could do this thing. And it just takes one little slip up, as you've been saying, and the whole thing. And yes, I'd heard about that the South almost, I forgot what it was, but I know they were pretty close, and they did one thing instead of another thing, and that was the beginning of the end for going the other way. But it's people don't. I don't know if you found this with people who've read the book. People don't sort of seem to think about something like that. You know, it's like carte blanche that, they were the best people. They won it in the end. Not necessarily. You know, one mistake, one slip up, charge of the Light Brigade, the Battle of Balaclava, the order didn't get through, and the people just went straight for the guns and died.
It's in the book too, by the way, the Charge of the Light Brigade. Apparently there was a misunderstanding. They were seeing it from one side, and they didn't realize that on the other side of the hill it was different views. They were ordering to go one direction when there was confusion. They're actually supposed to attack in a different direction. And then the man who said, well, are we supposed to charge it? Well, there are the guns. And they start charging. Then the man, I think, may have realized that his mistake. And he was, the officer was riding out in front of them trying to stop them. And he was one of the first ones killed.
Yeah.
Okay, and so they kept on going the wrong direction. And they managed to get to the Turkish guns briefly. But then, of course, they were thrown back.
Exactly.
Of orders.
The thing is, you look back at that, and it was a battle, and yet you had like a grandstand of rich and famous sitting there watching it. You know, they were on the hill watching it, and you know, well, we would have got to be, these people have got to be here, and they want a good show, you know. And it's crazy when you, I mean, it's all crazy anyway, but yeah, this, you read about stuff like that, it does go on a bit. Make you do so, but what's gone on is our talk, because I'm nearly running out of time. So what I'm going to do now, Jared, anyway, is hand the show over to you and have you tell everybody where they can find out more about you and about your book.
Well, thank you very much. Again, a lot of fun. The book is a lot of fun. We make a point that back in history class, it sometimes was dull as death, but we have a lot of exciting stories, big personalities, a lot of unusual things happening. But if you go to tinyblundersbigdisasters.com, okay, that will take you straight to my website. And there is a great book trailer there. It just runs about a minute and 10 seconds. And there's also a portrait gallery. You can you go down there and you hover your mouse over a particular picture. And, for example, Robert Lee is the first one, and the statement jumps forward. Most people do not realize how close the South came to win the war. And, you know, then you go down, and here's Eisenhower. You hover the mouse over Eisenhower. The statement jumps forward. Behind the famous smile, there was a man known for his short, explosive temper who was very unforgiving of subordinates who let him down. Okay, and then here's another one over here about Matthew Ridgway. Here's another one over here about Hitler, and also Joseph Goebbels, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the portrait gallery is kind of fun. And you can go to the portrait gallery and just go straight to the chapter you want to read, or you can read it the traditional way from the beginning to end, or you can go to the portrait gallery and pick and choose which ones you want. But Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters, tinyblundersbigdisasters.com, and then order 10, 15 books if you want to.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jared, for being a guest on the show. It's been fascinating. One of these sort of things you could talk about for hours, going on about the various different bits and pieces from history, as we all know. Good luck with the book, and hopefully get your trip into Poland as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Barry. Enjoyed it very much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Well, there you go. My guest today, Jared Knott, J-A-R-E-D, and Knott is K-N-O-T-T, Jared Knott. And we've been talking about his great book, fascinating stuff, Tiny Blunders and Big Disasters, 39 Tiny Mistakes that basically changed the world forever. As we've been talking about the sort of different little bits and pieces, people make a mistake, you know, turn left instead of right. It's that fascinating, that one about the Titanic, and they didn't have binoculars in the crow's nest. Amazing stuff when you hear about that. Well, that's it for now. We'll have a show tomorrow. I haven't got a live guest, so it'll be a repeat show. And then I'll be back in the new year. I'll have a week off between Christmas and New Year. But there'll be shows, if some repeat shows. But I'll be back in the new year. But, of course, don't forget, in the meantime, on a Sunday between 5 and 6, you have Those Are the Days, music from the 20th century. And we're going through Christmas stuff this month, just to play stuff for you. And then the Swinging 60s between 6 and 7, music from the 60s. We'll have some of that. Anyway, that's it for now. Of course, I've got one thing left to say. Don't forget...